Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. And as always, I'm so glad that you can join me as we dive deep into the cardboard boxes and the plastic top loaders and the binders with all the little sleeves in them, or perhaps your stack of random cards that you may have just laying around the house. It's the most wonderful time of the year to be a sports fan because baseball is gearing up for the playoffs. The NFL is underway. College football is underway. Pretty soon hockey and basketball will be underway. If you're a sport fan, September, October into early November is just the best time to be alive. And especially if you live up north, it's cooling down a little bit, but it's the cold weather for the holidays. You know, it's kind of that cheery part of winter. After New Year's Eve, you couldn't give a crap about cold weather. You hate it. And then, you know, here in the South, it cools down a little bit. The days of 90-degree highs and 98% humidity are short and few and far between, which is a blessing. And while this time of year is great for all of the seasons that I brought up, whether it's weather or a particular sport because a certain season is starting or it's coming to a conclusion, there is one other season that we're in full force right now that I used to like, but I just can't stand anymore. Yes, it is pumpkin spice season, or as I like to refer to it as pumpkin spice Armageddon. Because if somebody could manufacture dog poop that had a pumpkin spice taste or odor to it, they would sell it. They absolutely would. And you know what? Because there is a pumpkin spice mafia out there, or a pumpkin spice cult. If you came up with pumpkin spice dog poop, somebody would buy it. And I used to like pumpkin spice because the smell, really more the smell than the taste. That was my son's cat, Bob Tortilla. He's not big on pumpkin spice either. I think he's possessed right now. But anyways, pumpkin spice, I used to love it because the smell more than the taste reminded me of the fall. You know, pumpkin spice season used to start in late September, and you get the smell and then the taste of the pumpkin spice and whatever you're eating. And it makes you think of fall harvest and Halloween and the prelude to Thanksgiving. And Thanksgiving's my favorite holiday. I like Thanksgiving more than Christmas. So, you know, pumpkin spice, when it became kind of a thing, what, maybe 15 or so years ago, I used to absolutely love it. And mostly because my pumpkin spice consumption came through beer, probably a lot like you. And over time, I had a special liking to primarily Shipyard pumpkin spice because, in my opinion, that had the perfect mixture of pumpkin and spice. I think when it comes to pumpkin spice beer, some brewers go way overboard on the spice and you can't actually taste the pumpkin. So, you know, that's how I liked pumpkin spice. And, you know, once the pumpkin spice ales came out in mid to late September, you would have one, you would, you know, recall, oh yes, it's almost Halloween and it's almost Thanksgiving and, you know, it's going to cool off just a little bit temperature wise. And you got excited. Well, now, you know, the pumpkin spice beer is coming out the first week in August, and especially here in Florida. I mean, I don't want a pumpkin spiced anything in August because it's not 90 degrees with 98% humidity. It's 95 degrees with 98% humidity. And the heat index is a few degrees, cooler than the seventh level of hell here. You could tell I love living in Florida in the summer. So you've got the pumpkin spice beers, and then, you know, Starbucks humps the whole pumpkin spice thing, and everyone has pumpkin spice. There's pumpkin spice Cheerios. There's pumpkin spice, like I said, beer and coffee. There's pumpkin spice, you know, like peanut butter spreads. I actually saw, and this is not a joke, saw this a few weeks ago, Spam is putting out a limited edition pumpkin spice Spam, which, you know, when you think about it, if you mix your Thanksgiving ham and the pumpkin pie and your yams together, you know, when it's all, you know, fermenting in your stomach, it's, I guess you can think of that as pumpkin spice Spam, but no, I don't want that. Why would I want pumpkin spiced Spam? I can't stand what I used to like in pumpkin spiced beer in August. So my whole rant about pumpkin spice is what used to be a really good thing has been corrupted, bastardized, and just shoved into our faces and rubbed into the dirt. You know, pretty much, it's almost like when you go into a shopping plaza or a mall or a Target or a Walmart, and you know, it's October 1st, and they're already pushing aside the Halloween stuff for Christmas decorations. And you're like, wait, you know, we're still a month away from, you know, Halloween. I haven't even bought my kid's costume yet. And what about Thanksgiving? Well, screw Thanksgiving. That turkey can shove Thanksgiving up his floopus. It's Christmas time. Well, it's October 1st. Screw October. It's Christmas time. But, you know, I want to have Halloween and Thanksgiving. Buy some peppermint candy canes. It's forced on us now. The pumpkin spice thing, it was so good. Christmas used to be good. You waited until the day after Thanksgiving. Then I put my decorations and my shopping up. But again, you know, much like there's an audience for pumpkin spice flavored dog poop, if somebody makes it, you know, there's an audience for Christmas decorations on October 1st. It happens. But at some point in time, that audience dries up and it just becomes a huge annoyance. Now, because Christmas is such a major retail holiday, it's not like Christmas shopping or, you know, Black Friday deals or Cyber Monday deals or, you know, Christmas decorations showing up in stores in October, like that's going to go away. But I truly believe the pumpkin spice Armageddon will eventually die down just a little bit because it's just gone too far. And I bring up pumpkin spice because it is very representative of the set that we're going to take a look at this week. I opened up a box on our YouTube channel of 93 Top Stadium Club Series 1. If you just go onto YouTube, if you didn't see the link yesterday at Wax and Gum Stains on our Twitter timeline, just go on YouTube, type in Wax Ecstatic 1993 Top Stadium Club Break. You will see what I'm talking about here. Top Stadium Club in 1993 was the pumpkin spice of baseball cards. When Top Stadium Club came out in 1991, it was kind of the preeminent pumpkin spice, not the original pumpkin spice. No, that belongs to Upper Deck in 1989. But Top Stadium Club comes out in 1991, totally changes the game again. Not only raises the bar on the premium sets that come out, but it also sets the mold for the base sets starting in 1992. Every base set in 1992 is essentially as good, if not better, than a premium set from 1991, such as Top Stadium Club or Fleer Ultra or Leaf Studio. So the bar is quickly raised and the premium quality product is shoved into our faces. Now, if Top Stadium Club and let's say Upper Deck, if those were the only two players in the game and they're pushing out their pumpkin spice set every year, then by 1993 and certainly later, 94, 95, 96, you're probably still buying it because you look forward to that pumpkin spice. Ah, it's a sign that baseball season is well underway. The base sets came out in February. Here it is. It's late March, early April. The premium Stadium Club comes out. Ah. But of course, Top Stadium Club and Upper Deck were not the only premium brands. Like I said, you had Ultra, you had Leaf Studio, and you had all the base sets ratcheting up their game to where they were very similar to Top Stadium Club. And if you recall, if you go back to 1993 and look at the base sets, you know, Tops had ditched the gray cardboard. They had the better quality cardboard stock. They had the clearer pictures. They had the larger sets. They had the gold foil rookie inserts. You had, and that was at the low end of the spectrum, too. I think, Fleer in 1993 was trailing off tremendously, even though they put out a pretty decent card. Fleer and Score in 1993 were starting to trail away. Tops was more of the higher end of the low end of cards, if you will. But you look at all the other sets from 1993, Donruss was practically a premium set if you compared it to the 91 Top Stadium Club and Bowman cards, or Upper Deck cards. Speaking of Bowman, by 93, that had become a high-end product focusing on rookies. Upper Deck was at its peak in 1993. You wanted the glossiest of glossy cards. The 93 base set for Upper Deck was definitely that. And then, of course, you had Fleer Ultra, which was phenomenal in 1993, as it was in 1992. You had the Leafs set, the Studio set, Pinnacle as well. So you just had all of this pumpkin spice all at once. And while you may be a fan of pumpkin spice, and certainly in 1993, there were a lot of people buying the Stadium Clubs and the Fleer Ultras and all the other sets that were, you know, coming out here. But when you actually look at what's in those sets, it's not a whole lot. And that is why I equate 93 Top Stadium Club to the pumpkin spice Armageddon that we are living through right now, where everything has a pumpkin spice tinge to it, whether you like it or not. And what should have been a good thing was just so quickly ramped up, oversaturated, shoved down our throats to where there was a backlash. And you're seeing more and more people with pumpkin spice going, yeah, I just don't need pumpkin spice in everything. Put a little in my beer. Maybe I'll have that special coffee one day, but I just don't need this constantly. Well, Stadium Club was starting to fall into that category in 1993. And there was a backlash against everything in the hobby shortly thereafter. If you were still collecting in 1993, much like I was, you started falling out from the hobby. Now, granted, my age and my priorities were a big factor in that. As I've said, in 1993, I turned 16 that October. So when you're 16 and you're a junior in high school, you're spending less time, attention, and money on baseball cards. And, you know, maybe you're working a job, or you have a car that you have to take care of, or you're dating. You know, you need to save money for the movies and the trips to the restaurant. And if you're really lucky, you know, protection. You're not looking at, you know, let me get that Tim Pugh rookie card from Top Stadium Club Series 1. So that was, you know, certainly part of it for me. But by 1993, people had been so quickly inundated with premium this, that, and the other, and subsets and glossy cards and all these variations of sets and subsets and individual cards. And plus, there was so much of it being produced that it was just overflowing. We just had too much, even within one season. And you would still see the 93 Top Stadium Club Series 1 cards in your hobby shops in the spring of 1994. And that's not a good thing. And in fact, this Top Stadium Club box, which I bought at our local card show, my usual connection for junk wax, it was purchased by him at a Target. And I know this because in the cellophane wrapping is the original Topps factory wrapping, and there was an orange sticker on it, an orange price tag that said vintage $19.99. And that was something that Target in particular, Walmart was doing it too, but I remember Target was doing it a lot. Mid to late 90s, early 2000s, they would buy these boxes of packs wholesale, or even full sets. I bought an 87 Fleer update set from Walmart. When was it? 12, 13 years ago for like $8. So, you know, they were basically buying these wholesale items that were still sitting in a warehouse somewhere. And they would, you know, put an extra layer of cellophane on it and resell it. So I'm assuming that my connection bought this box in the year 1999 or thereabouts for $19.99. And I bought it off of him for, I think it was $10. It was not that much. And in fact, I bought a box of Series 2 as well, which I have not opened yet. But for the hell of it, I just might one day. I don't think I'll make a show out of it just because there's really not all that much difference between Series 1 and Series 2. And you know, much like the pumpkin spice stuff, which will all be sitting on the clearance rack come February, there's a lot of baseball card pumpkin spice, if you will, sitting on the racks of all of the hobby shops and retail outlets for many, many months after the fact. So we're going to discuss this a little bit more in great detail. Why did a pretty good product, actually 93 Stadium Club's a nice card. Why did a pretty good product just not really gain traction amongst the ever-growing pumpkin spices of the hobby in the early to mid 1990s? And, you know, what can you do about it today? This is a bargain bin beauty, not only because of the price. Like I said, I think I paid $10 for this box, maybe even less. I don't recall. I've had it for several months. I know I didn't break my budget. You know, I go to these card shows with $20 in hand, and most times I'm staying within my budget. So it's not just a bargain bin beauty in terms of the price, but because it is so affordable, and as I'll discuss the way that the cards were sequenced in these particular series in these boxes, not a whole lot of duplication. So you can put together some sets pretty quickly if you're just looking to add to your collection. Plus, there were a lot of bonuses in the Stadium Club cards, which we will get to in just a moment. Now, before we dive into the pumpkin spice of baseball cards, let's do our usual housekeeping here. Wax Ecstatic comes your way every other Friday, so our next show will be coming 2 weeks from today. That is Friday, September the 27th. And if you have friends or family members who collect and who haven't followed the show yet, share it with them, please. Let them know that it does come every other Friday. Noon Eastern is when we drop the podcast on our home base of Audio Boom, but it also gets picked up by numerous RSS feeds. It is heard on Apple Podcast, formerly known as iTunes, of course, as well as iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, Google Play, and Spotify. And if you haven't already shared our timeline from Twitter with your friends and families and fellow collectors, it is at Wax and Gum Stains, which is open 24/7. And we have a very interesting question from the Twitter timeline that I failed to get to in the last show. And it was a great question when it came across, and I made a mental note to do it. That's the problem, though, a mental note. Unless I write things down, they typically don't get done. So we'll address that. It's about hand collating sets, and it's an interesting question from one of our listeners. But it's open 24/7, and you can talk about particular players or cards or sets or anything in the hobby in general. Just tag us in there. It's nice to be brought into some conversations, and we certainly have been over the last couple of weeks. Also, no matter how you listen to Wax Ecstatic, if the platform you listen to it on offers you the opportunity to comment on the show or to rate it, please do. And especially with Apple Podcasts, the way Apple Podcasts works is if you rate a show, if you give it 5 stars, then it moves it up the ladder, you know, gives it a little more exposure. If you listen to a podcast, sometimes depending on the device you're listening to, you'll have a little menu that comes up that says, oh, you may also like this. And basically anybody who's listening to anything sports related or certainly hobby related can get redirected to Wax Ecstatic. So I'm not begging for a 5-star review. I want you to be honest. But if you think that this show deserves a few stars and some nice commentary, please do that as it helps promote the program within the algorithm for Apple Podcasts. And like it says, like I said, it does that on other platforms as well. I believe iHeartRadio does that, certainly Google Play. So if you can do that, that helps promote the show internally. That's the easiest way to get the word out other than word of mouth. Also, we do appreciate any cash donations that we can get, as those cash donations, again, 100% of them go right back into the show. I can't stress that enough. One of two ways. One, it goes to paying the annual fee for Audio Boom. It does cost money to host the show on Audio Boom, but also keep our archive nice and healthy. And that archive can be listened to on all those other platforms that I mentioned. And your money goes to the cash payments, the purchases of these cards, whether it's boxes of cards, which I like to open up every now and then, or the occasional stray pack or two, but also it goes to paying for individual cards. So, you know, like some of those stray cards that we were talking about in our last podcast, you know, the $8, you know, or the $10 Reggie Jackson or the $12 Harmon Killebrew cards that may have, you know, a little fuzziness on the corners and are great bargains. We can purchase those to discuss them and showcase them and keep the show going, mixing it up just a little bit. And as I mentioned, anytime that we have any excess cards, any dupes along the way, especially with some of these junk wax era packs, you get a lot of cards out of every pack and out of every box. We package them up. Actually, this week, sending out that box to Commons for Kids. They're going to get about 3,000 cards. Commons for Kids, a great group, basically take all of these commons from current sets and past sets as well. They repackage them, donate them to kids who are in hospitals, maybe in cancer centers, or you know, having care at home, physical therapy, stuff like that. Great way to not only take in a charitable cause, but also a great way to keep kids in the hobby. There may be kids that just can't afford cards. Giving them a pack of cards, even if they are a few years old in some cases, or maybe not star players, it's a nice gesture. It gives them something to focus on, take their mind off of whatever ailments they are dealing with. Now, after the Commons for Kids package goes out, we'll start over the next few months collecting cards for Kidority cards, and you can find out more about them. Go ahead and give them a search at Kidority cards. And basically, for a low cost per month, you or your child, rather, will get a package of cards of his or her favorite team. So if your kid's a Dodgers fan, you sign him up, you get that Dodger card or that Dodger pack every few weeks. And again, it's a great way to engage kids in collecting. They not only get the new cards, but they also get some classic cards, the cards that you or I may just toss to the side. You know, for a kid who's 7 or 8 years old, it's kind of neat to look at cards from the 80s and early 90s, from well before they were born. Much like when you and I were kids, we'd be looking back at cards from the 50s and 60s. And if you could pick up some common cards from those eras when we were children, likewise, kids these days, they appreciate looking at those cards that are 20, 30 years old, as the case may be. So again, your cash donations via paypal.me/waxecstatic. Go back to the program either in just the maintenance of the website and the RSS feeds, or to the purchase of the products where, again, excess product is donated to Commons for Kids and Kidority cards. So know that if you're donating $5 or $50 or somewhere in between, we could get a lot of $20 and $25 donations. All that money is going to a good cause, not just maintaining the program, but helping us buy the product and also spreading that product out to young collectors everywhere. So again, Wax Ecstatic's PayPal Dropbox, if you will, is paypal.me/waxecstatic. If you have made a donation, great. Thank you very much. We've had some repeat donations as well. Thank you so much if you've been one of those repeat people. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And if you still haven't done it yet, again, we don't ask for much. Even if it's just as little as $5, it goes a long way with this program. Trust me. Now, going back to that question that was on our timeline for wax and gum stains, a great question sent back on August 27th by Elwood Outlaw says, how do you store your hand-collated sets? And do you remember the last card you had to get to complete your first set? Mine was 1983 Topps Lonnie Smith, pulled from the rough estimate 347th wax pack I opened that year. Well, a lot of great questions there, Elwood. First of all, let me address the last card I had to get to complete my first set. I honestly don't remember. And I'm trying to think what my first completed hand-collated set was, because I think it may have actually been a hockey set. I think it would have been the 91-92 Top Stadium Club hockey set, which was, if I recall correctly, a 400-card set. Might have been 300. But it was the first year of Stadium Club. They used basically the same template for hockey as they did baseball. And I really loved how the hockey cards looked. I loved the smell, even though I'm sure there's some very bad chemical reaction from the UV coating from those cards. And I just remember being able to afford a couple of boxes. I think a store that I used to frequent a lot in my childhood neighborhood, I think they had them pretty cheap, like maybe $20 a box, which for Stadium Club back then was pretty affordable. Now, it was also hockey, and here in Tampa, you know, hockey was just starting in the 92-93 season. So much like I was talking about excess product, this would have been some excess product from the year before. So I think that's why they marked it down. But I remember buying maybe a couple of boxes and being able to hand collate the entire set for a pretty good cost. I don't recall what the last card was, unfortunately, but what I do recall, some of the cards in particular, the Wayne Gretzky card, which featured the great one in a media scrum talking to reporters, Jaromir Jagr, that was just his, I think, second season in the NHL. Also, some young stars like Sergei Fedorov, Mike Modano, you know, established stars, Mark Messier, Cam Neely, Ray Bourque. So, you know, I remember those cards. I remember seeing the rookie cards on the back. That amazed me because, again, you know, growing up in Florida and not having a ton of hockey cards around here, it was neat to see what some of those cards from the, you know, 1970s and early 80s, like Larry Robinson. You know, Robinson was wrapping up his career around this time, and to see a 1975-76 Topps Larry Robinson rookie card was just kind of neat. Very similar, as we'll discuss, is seeing the rookie cards for guys like Dave Winfield or Carlton Fisk in these 93 Topps Stadium Club baseball cards. So that, I believe, that would have been the first set that I hand collated. It would have happened around probably spring of 1993, I'm guessing. Shortly thereafter, I completed a 1987 Topps baseball set, and in fact, made my first sale of a hand collated set. And I think I've told you before, during the summer of 1993, I just bought box after box after box of 87 Topps cello packs with my hard-earned lawn mowing money. And I, through probably three or four cello boxes, was able to put together not only a complete set, but I also, you know, started up a, you know, a second set. I was probably about 100 cards shy of a complete set there. And I still remember to this day, it would have been in probably August of 93, my parents, we had a garage sale at our house. And I remember this because we had this garage sale, I think, the day before we went on a vacation. We spent a week over in Madeira Beach, which is about 30 minutes from where I lived, on the Gulf of Mexico. So we sold a whole bunch of stuff in our house, and we would split the proceeds, and basically everyone had a little vacation spending account. Well, my younger brother Dave and I, we had some baseball cards to sell. And of course, me being the entrepreneur at the tender age of 15, I had packs, I had single cards, I had a couple boxes, and I had a hand-collated 87 Topps set. And it was that first set that I put together, and I believe I sold it for $15. And I sold it to a lady who had a son who was probably around 8 or 10 years old. She was, or he was, getting into baseball card collecting again. It was all the buzz back then. And I actually sold her on why she should spend $15 on this 87 Topps set. And I pulled out, you know, I would put the premium cards, if you will, the Bonds and the Bo Jacksons and the Jose Canseco's, but even some of the Hall of Fame guys, the Mike Schmidts and the Nolan Ryans, I would put those in those little soft plastic sleeves. So I'd open up the box and I'd pull out some of the cards here. So, oh, here's this person's rookie card. Here's, you know, Hall of Famer, blah, blah, blah. And she bought it. And God bless her. I mean, she got a hell of a deal, and her kid didn't have to, you know, go through four boxes of cello packs to get a set together. Now, sadly, I don't think a hand collated set of 87 tops is valued at much more than $15 these days. You can probably get one for $10. Maybe mine that I assembled in 1993 is still floating around the flea markets of America somewhere. But I don't recall the last card. I just recall that that was the first set that I hand collated and sold. Now, I haven't sold sets then. I haven't hand collated a whole lot. I'm still a few cards short of completing a few sets, and that's something that I'm working on in my spare time. But one funny story, Elwood, about the collecting cards and trying to get that last card. And I know how hard it is. I have recently completed an 87 tops, a 91 top set, you know, getting those last cards. Sometimes it's murder if you're going the pack route because you're just hoping. And I recall, and I think I shared the story before in the podcast, but about a year ago, I went to a card show. I got a box of 87 tops for like $8. My buddy, Coach Mike, gets a box for like $8. And he just opens up the box and basically takes all the Bo Jacksons. He's got this fixation on 87 tops, Bo Jackson. And he gives me the rest. And I open up my box. And I basically need like four cards to complete the set. And yeah, this is a shotgun approach to trying to get four cards. But, you know, it's 87 tops. It's fun to open up. And I only got like two of the four cards after plowing through about 900 of these cards through my unopened packs and his open packs. I couldn't believe it. So to complete that set, I'm just going to order those two cards online because they're common cards. I forget who they are. But yeah, I've been through the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat of trying to complete a hand-collated set, getting that one card that I absolutely need. Now, your first question I do want to answer here, how do you store your hand-collated sets? I do it very simply. I put them in the cardboard boxes. And in fact, when I decide that I'm going to hand-collate a set, so especially a top set, a lot of these top sets from the late 80s and early 90s, there's 792 cards. I get an 800 count box, and I will write on the side like 1987 tops. I'll put a big square and then I'll put the word complete next to it. And then once I complete it, I put a big fat black Sharpie check mark in that box. And it sits in a box. That's basically it. I don't do anything with them. I work so hard to get them. Actually, in all honesty, I think at a later point in time, or maybe not that late, it might be a birthday or a Christmas gift for all I know, I'm going to pass on some of these sets to my son, who is going to be turning 10 in January. And he is still of that age where baseball cards are cool and he likes to collect them. I know, you know, much like I was when I was 15 or 16 and I'm distracted by boobs, he will be too. And you're not buying the cards or you know, valuing them as much as you did when you were younger. So I do have, you know, an 87 top set. I've got some, I've got a starter 91 and 89 top set made from, you know, packs that I've bought, you know, independent of the show, packs that I've bought on the side because you can get them so cheap. So that's pretty much what I do with them nowadays. For me, hand collating sets, it's just, you know, it's a personal to-do list. It's something fun to do in your spare time. You know, let's be honest, a 91 tops hand collated set, I'm not going to get more than $15 for it. I'm not even going to bother to put it up for sale. It's just a neat thing to have. And I can store it in a cardboard box, which sits in the back corner of my daughter's closet. But I know that if I want to give it as a gift, or, you know, to somebody like those starter sets, you know, if somebody wanted a starter 91 top set that's got like 500 cards in it, I can gift it to them. You know, hey, for $5 here, I've built 2/3 of this set for you already. And you can buy the other packs or individual cards and complete it for probably an additional $5. So that's what I do with my hand collated sets. But it is a great question again, or a great set of questions there, Elwood. And I want to offer it up to our listeners as well. What is, if you can recall that first set that you hand collated, what was that last card you needed to complete it? If you can't recall your first set, What's the most memorable set? You know, maybe you had spent a lot of time and money to put together, I don't know, 78 tops, for example. And it's kind of hard to collect all those cards. And all you needed was like an Al Bunbury card or whatever to complete the set. And it took you, you know, like in your words, Elwood, 347 packs to finally find that 78 tops Al Bunbury card. So a great question there, Elwood. And again, to all of our listeners, you can answer any questions or ask any questions or answer anything else that pops up on our timeline at Wax and Gum Stains at any time. Now let's talk a little more about Topps Stadium Club in 1993, you know, the pumpkin spice card, as I mentioned. And this despite the fact that when it comes to the design of the card, it was very good. I don't know if it was as good as the 91 set, but pretty good. You had full photography, you know, no borders, minimal graphics, all kept down to the lower portions of the card. Great pictures too, what Topps called high definition photo technology. Now today we throw around high definition, that phrase. I mean, they sell sunglasses that are high definition. Now, they normally sell those in those commercials at 2 a.m. on channel 892 of your cable box. So, you know, it's only so much high definition-ism that you can get out of that. But in 1993, high definition, that was kind of a new term there. And I'm sure it was trademarked, a high definition photo technology, not using the Kodak marks here. If you remember when Stadium Club first came out in 1991, Kodak and its logos were prominently featured. So perhaps that marketing deal with Kodak ended by 1993 and Topps was just going with this more blanket statement, high definition. But that was an interesting thing that I saw on the box and on the back of the packs. Because, you know, high definition was not a term that was used an awful lot in 1993. We were still very much in the days of VHS tapes, standard televisions, and compact discs were the most technologically advanced forms of media. The internet was still being birthed at this time. Before DVDs, we were working with laser discs, which were basically DVDs, but they were the size of LP records. So that was kind of inconvenient. So I thought that was kind of a neat little quirk there. But despite the great photography and the good design, and also as I, you know, opened up all of the packs in this box, great sequencing here, because series one was only 300 cards and you only got 24 packs of 14 cards in these boxes. Not like the old days of base sets with 36 packs of 15 or 17 cards, depending on the set. You don't have much duplication. In fact, as I went through all of these cards, which fit nicely into a 330 card box, I only have probably 20 dupes, if that, not that many. And the ones that I do have duplicates for are some pretty good cards. Like I know there's an extra Frank Thomas and a Larry Walker member's choice card in here. So, you know, certainly, you know, not your Tim Fortunio cards. You don't have 8 of those floating around in this box here. But, you know, some pretty good cards, not a lot of duplication. You were pretty much guaranteed a special card in each pack. Now, by special card, that's a very broad term, either a member's choice card or a special insert card, which I'll get to in a moment. But definitely a star card. I noticed as I was opening these packs, typically the last card in the pack was a notable name. And sometimes I would get a pack that had a lot of star power. I would have Greg Maddux and, you know, Cal Ripken and who else, like, you know, Benny Santiago, you know, bigger name back then. So, you know, you did have some packs that did punch some star power. You would have 3 or 4 notable star cards or a big rookie card. But then again, you had a whole lot of that was kind of mixed into it. Now, one of the big flaws of 93 Stadium Club is that there are really no dominant rookies in that set. And not just in Series 1. I'm talking about the entire 750 cards set. Series 1 was 300 cards, Series 2 was 300 cards, Series 3 was 150. And even though they designated the last 10 numbers of each series for members' choice, and even though you had some unique insert cards, you know, by 1993, thanks to some of the big rookie cards of 1991 and 92, you know, everyone was waiting for that next Frank Thomas or that next Ken Griffey Jr. or that next Randy Johnson or Greg Maddux or Tom Glavin. You didn't really see that in the 93 Stadium Club set, which is kind of odd because you did have notable rookies coming up, especially Mike Piazza was the big rookie in 1993. And it's not like Topps was oblivious to Mike Piazza. He had a rookie card in the 1992 Bowman set. He already had a rookie card in the 93 base set. So, or actually it might've been 92, but anyways, he had a, you know, rookie cards already. You know, that's something that really could have been a big focus of the Stadium Club set. It really wasn't, even though 93 was his true rookie season. You also had some up and coming players throughout the big leagues at this time. Mo Vaughn was coming up. Like I mentioned, Piazza, Alex Rodriguez was going to be a big name starting in 1993. Derek Jeter as well, even though Jeets was still a few years away from making the major leagues. You know, why not make a Stadium Club card for him in the basic 1993 set? Wasn't there. So it's really lacking in star rookie cards. Like I said, you've got Hall of Famers. You've got some star players. As I'm ripping open through these packs, Craig Biggio, Roberto Alomar, as I mentioned, Cal Ripken. You've got Frank Thomas. And that's just in Series 1. You've got plenty of other big names in Series 2 and Series 3. There's a Barry Bonds variation, which the value of the variation and the error card are about the same. They're about $1.50 from what I've seen. And, you know, you've got some star power there, you know, Gary Sheffield member's choice, Larry Walker, but just nothing that really grabs you, nothing that makes you go, wow, this is really something. And, you know, with each card or each pack, Topps would put in these insert cards, these info cards. So one info card is talking about the special cards in Series 1, including special cards noting the 3,000th career hit for each Robin Yount and George Brett. Also, special cards noting the Colorado Rockies and the Florida Marlins, who were playing in their first year. Now, we're going to talk about that Marlins insert card featuring Nigel Wilson later on when we talk about the players in some of these packs here. Also, there was an info card talking about just the basic set, you know, how it broke down over three series and 750 cards, how they had a special insert called the First Day Production cards, where basically the first production line of cards that went out had a special stamp to it. And I did get a First Day Production card, but it was a common player here. So they talk about the First Day Production logo, fewer than 2,000 of each Stadium Club card having that First Day Production stamp. Allegedly, you had to take Topps for their words. And of course, the master photos, and I did get a master photo winner card for a Kirby Puckett master photo. Now, unfortunately, I should have redeemed this card by January 31st, 1994. So I can't blame the Postal Service and going, well, my dear friends at Topps, I did wait 25 years to get this, but I guess I'll pass. And you did have the master photos, which were basically the uncropped photo cards for guys such as Kirby Puckett, but also Delino DeShields, Mike Socha, Cal Ripken, Tim Wakefield. Some of the other Series 1 photos, Sam Militello, okay, Rick Sutcliffe, Danny Tartable, Yankees fans will love that one, or the irascible Bip Roberts. That is the master photo card we all want. And there was a, I remember having a master photo card of Nolan Ryan, but it's just not as valuable these days. You know, they're only like $3 or $4. But I did get one of those inserts here. So had I opened this in 1993, perhaps I would have filled out the back and sent a self-addressed stamped envelope to get this really cool Kirby Puckett card or not. Because as a Blue Jays fan at this time, I still despised Kirby Puckett and the Twins for what they did to the Jays in 1991. Now, there was also an insert card about how you could join the Stadium Club, which when Stadium Club started in 1991, this was one of the premium things that you could basically buy into. So it was a very unique marketing ploy by Topps, not just to sell cards, but to basically start a club where they data mined, they got all of your information and could bombard you with all sorts of merchandise and special offers. And if you wanted to join the Stadium Club in 1993, you could basically fill out this card and you could send in a check or money order. Boy, those were the days. Send in a check or money order. Life was tough before PayPal. I don't know how we did it. For $29.95, you got a one-year membership, or you could send a check or money order for $24.95 plus 5 proof of purchase seals from Stadium Club wax packs. Now, Topps was gloating about this on the front of the card. They go, well, if you do this, each wrapper is valued at $1. So you save $5. Oh, baloney. You couldn't buy a pack of Topps Stadium Club for $1. You typically spent $2. I think that was the MSRP back then. $2 for a pack. So basically, by spending $10 for Topps, you were saving $5, or in a sense, spending $5 more for this exclusive membership into Topps Stadium Club. And then you could also renew your club membership, and because they already had your name on hand, they could bill you later. Now, what did the Topps Stadium Club membership get you back in the day? Well, you had a limited edition members-only Stadium Club card. So again, the exclusive subset to the subsets. Plus, you got Topps Magazine. Did anybody actually subscribe to that? I'm curious. If you had Topps Magazine, I'd like to know what Topps Magazine was like, because I didn't subscribe to that. My Bible was the Beckett Baseball Card Monthly. I didn't need Topps Magazine. You also had the personalized Stadium Club membership and ID number. Now, I don't know if that got you into the back door of the nightclub, but I'm sure it was pretty cool. Plus, special members-only buying opportunities. So remember what I said about pumpkin spice on the clearance table in February? Well, if you wanted your pumpkin spice Topps Stadium Club cards, they were available to Stadium Club members first, I'm sure, come September and October, and then it was dumped on the unassuming public that following winter. So that's what it was like to be a member of the Topps Stadium Club. Now, how does this all tie into pumpkin spice? Well, again, like I started out the show, it was just too much of a good thing, and really a bland product. So good design, good assortment of cards, easy to collect. Like if you bought a box of each, you could assemble a set on your own fairly easily. And, you know, good photography. It was a premium card, but no big rookies, nothing spectacular with the star cards that were in there. And looking at the inserts, nothing that great. You know, the members' choice cards kind of ran their run. The photo cards. Now, I get the master photo for Kirby Puckett. That's a great card to have. Why would I really want the Bip Roberts card or the Sam Militello card or the Carlos Baerga or Joe Oliver cards? That's really not a premium. I don't want to go out of my way to get one of these cards. No offense to Joe Oliver or Bip Roberts or Sam Militello, but that's really not a special card there. Now, if it's an autographed Carlos Baerga master photo card, well, that's kind of neat. Okay, yeah, I might actually put forth the effort to send that out in the mail and wait for it to come 30 days later. But that wasn't really a great insert. So all the things that made Stadium Club so special in 91 and 92... we're now just kind of middle-of-the-road promotions in 1993, and they're being outdone by the competition. You're having better inserts. You're having autograph cards. You're having all sorts of bells and whistles being thrown into the game by Upper Deck, especially Upper Deck, but also through Fleer Ultra and the Leaf Studio sets. There's refractor cards are starting to come out around this time. Like I said, gold foil cards as well. So all the bells and whistles that worked for Topps Stadium Club in 91 and 92, it's now just kind of, okay, that's neat in 1993. Plus, as is often the complaint of sets from the mid-90s, the inserts created too many subsets. So if I'm a fan of Kirby Puckett, in 1986, if I wanted to collect every Kirby Puckett card, well, I needed to collect a Topps, a Fleer, and a Donruss. Okay, sports flicks if I wanted to be adventurous. And all right, if I really want to do it, okay, maybe the Topps glossy card that comes out in the rack packs, or maybe the Fleer All-Star insert card that, you know, comes in the jumbo pack. So I'd have to look for it a little bit. But my Kirby Puckett collection in 1986 consists of basically what, 7, 8 cards maybe. You know, if you want to talk about league leaders or team leader cards that may be out there, okay, maybe 10 cards. That was it. Well, if you were a Kirby Puckett fan in 1993 and you wanted every card, you had to get Topps, Fleer, Donruss, Score, Upper Deck, Bowman. Oh, wait, there's more. I needed Stadium Club, Fleer Ultra. I needed Donruss Elite. I needed Scores Pinnacle. I needed, what else did I need? I needed Starting Lineup. I needed the Classic Four Sport. I needed the Master Photo from Top Stadium Club. You see where I'm going here? All of a sudden, if I'm a Kirby Puckett fan, it's not just maybe 10 cards. It's quite literally 30. And it's hard to track those down, and especially if you're a kid, it's hard to afford those, because some of those special insert cards, they're going to set you back $4, $5, $6 a pop. And now, you know, what used to be a collection of maybe, I don't know, $15, $20 in 1986, well, now you're spending $100 on some of these cards. And it's hard to keep track, it's hard to afford, and quite frankly, it's hard to manage, because now, you know, instead of having just one page of cards in your binder of your favorite player for 1 year, you know, now you need 3 or 4 cards or 3 or 4 pages for all these cards. And your Kirby Puckett folder becomes a Kirby Puckett, you know, yellow pages practically. So a lot of the little things that made Stadium Club so special and made it stand out from the rest, because nobody else was doing it in 1991, certainly by 92, as the base sets were becoming more premium, that was reducing the margin between Stadium Club and everyone else. And then by 93, you know, again, my memories of the card business in 1993, it was just, there was just so much of everything, so much. And it was all starting to look alike. The lower end base sets, you know, the Fleers and the Donrusses and the Tops were looking alike. The upper end base sets were looking a lot alike. The premium sets were looking a lot alike. And that's why when I, you know, was thinking about what to talk about on the show, I'm thinking I'm going to open the Stadium Club, because even though I was still an active collector in 1993 and I was still buying new cards in 1993, I didn't buy a lot of Stadium Club. I may have bought 2 or 3 packs. And I turned my focus on Tops and Upper Deck that particular year. I also bought a lot of Fleer Ultra, if I remember correctly. But I spent a lot of money on my Tops and Upper Deck, and I was investing more in vintage cards, you know, those 87 Tops, or I'd buy lots of cards from the 70s as opposed to buying the new stuff, because there was just too much of the new stuff. It was too much of the same from brand to brand, set to set. And really nothing that swayed me to buy a little bit of everything, as opposed to just kind of putting my money towards 2 or 3 sets that I really liked in particular. And that is a trend that would continue throughout the mid-1990s, and as we all know, contributed to the downfall, the oversaturation of the hobby by the late 1990s. For those of us who were teenagers or perhaps in our early 20s collecting in the early 90s, by then you're just throwing your hands in your air. You're going, okay, whatever. I just don't want to spend the time and frustration of trying to track these gazillion copies of cards down. And the bottom fell out. And of course, by the early 2000s, the hobby was kind of rebuilding to where we are today. Now, the Stadium Club brand is still alive and well by Topps. It is a premium brand that does have some unique bells and whistles. And much like everything that's in the Topps bucket, if you will, it you know, it attracts a certain type of customer. Some people love Stadium Club and swear by it. Others, including myself, I just quite frankly don't care. You know, my fix is on Heritage and the base sets, and not so much the Stadium Club or all the other different sets that Topps puts out. And that's not because it's a bad set or it's not worth your time for me, I'm just really not all that wrapped up in it. Now, let's wrap this up by taking a look at four of the players that are in the sets or the packs that I opened up, including one, you know, I mentioned during the video, as there was Doug DiCenzo in the foreground of one card getting thrown out at a routine, beginning of a double play at second base. You know, I had to say it in the Harry Carey voice. There's Doug DiCenzo. And I also mentioned that any Chicago Cub card in 1993, because, you know, I was laying around the house a lot in the summer of 93. So what did I do? Well, the Cubs, you know, they were still playing a ton of day games back then. So I just had the TV on WGN watching a pretty terrible Cubs team pretty much every day. So I had to pick a player who was with the Cubs in 1993 that I pulled from one of these four packs, talking about Jose Vizcaino. Now, Jose Vizcaino, of course, played for the Cubs from 91 to 93, but played for a whole host of teams throughout his career. And in fact, played in a lot of seasons. 17 total seasons. And he is one of only a handful of players. In fact, one of only three players who have played for all four of the former and current New York teams, the Yankees, the Mets, the Dodgers, and the Giants. So Jose Vizcaino, and who else? Here's a little baseball trivia for you. Who else played for all four teams? Daryl Strawberry and Ricky Lede. There's your Ricky Lede trivia for the day. Lede of the day. There you go. He is also a world champion, won with the Yankees in 2000, ironically against the Mets, the team that he played for from 1994 to 96. His career resume looks like this, as he was a late season call-up in 1989 with the Dodgers, later played with the Cubs, then the Mets, then the Indians, Giants, Dodgers, Yankees, Astros, Giants, and Cardinals. Whew. Now, he certainly was a hero for the New York Yankees in the year 2000. He played in four of the five games of the 2000 World Series and had a game-winning RBI single in Game 1, bottom of the 12th inning, in what was then the longest game in World Series history. Now, after picking up a ring with the Yankees, he was granted free agency, where he signed for a few years with the Astros, nearly pulled off the same postseason heroics in the 2005 World Series in Game 2, as he hit a two-run single with two outs in the ninth inning to tie the game. However, and this game was being played in Chicago, Scott Podsednik would homer in the bottom of the inning, and the White Sox would be well on their way to a sweep of the Houston Astros. Now, Vizcaino is currently in the front office of the Dodgers. He's a special assistant of baseball operations. He's held that position since 2008. And his son, Jose Jr., played college ball with Santa Clara University and was drafted by the San Francisco Giants in the seventh round of the 2015 Major League Draft. Now, if Jose Vizcaino is a great baseball name from 1993, here's another one. Andrew Neil Stankiewicz. Yes, Stanky. And of course, he got his nickname not only from the teenage minds of the New York Yankees players in the early 1990s, but of course, it played off rather well with former Yankee infielder Eddie Stanky. So Andy Stanky Stankiewicz was a product of the Yankees farm system, made his major league debut in 1992. Your prototypical middle infielder, very undersized, came in at 5'9", 165 pounds. Now, he was a star player for St. Paul High School in Santa Fe Springs, California, standout at Pepperdine, and in fact, still ranks in the top 10 in many offensive categories for Pepperdine, at last check, third on the school's all-time list in stolen bases. Now, as I mentioned, quickly moved his way up to the major leagues with the Yankees. The Yankees were such a moribund team, wrapped up in chaos in the early 90s, that Stankiewicz was one of the few notable players that you could hang your hopes on if you were a Yankees fan back then. Now, after his 1993 season with the Yankees. He'd go on to play for the Astros in 1994-95, a couple seasons with the Montreal Expos, and he would be a member of the inaugural Arizona Diamondbacks team in 1998. He would retire following the 98 season, got into the coaching and management field. In fact, was a star manager with the Yankees single-A affiliate, the Staten Island Yankees. They won the championship in 2005. A couple of notable Yankee players who were on that team. Brett Gardner, he was playing for the 05 Staten Island Yankees, still with the New York Yankees. And also Felix Rodriguez was on the team as well, Eduardo Nunez. So, a couple notable names who would have some pretty decent major league careers afterwards, part of Andy Stankiewicz's team in Staten Island. Now, he would move on to be an assistant baseball coach at Arizona State University, helping the ASU Sun Devils improve their fielding percentage. He also coached 29 players who were drafted, including three first-rounders. Ever since 2012, he has been the head coach of the Grand Canyon University Antelopes. That is awesome. The Lopes, not to be confused with Davy Lopes, but the Lopes of Grand Canyon University, finishing first in 2017 and 2018, actually won the WAC tournament in 2018, but finished fourth or tied for fourth in the 2019 season. So good to see Andy Stankiewicz, while not necessarily jumping out at you with his professional career, helping many, many others get a professional career going, starting in college first with Arizona State, or actually starting in the minor leagues with Staten Island, then moving on to Arizona State and Grand Canyon University. Now, a more notable name from the packs that we pulled here, our friends in Detroit will like this, Lance Parrish. Yes, the big wheel, Lance Michael Parrish, notably of the Detroit Tigers 1984 World Series team, but had quite the career all around, even though Phillies fans may want to deny that. Eight-time All-Star, also World Series champion, as I mentioned, in 1984. Three-time Gold Glove winner as a catcher from 83 to 85. Six-time Silver Slugger Award. Now, he was also a star football player in high school, was actually offered a scholarship to play at UCLA. Turned it down, however. He was drafted as a third baseman by the Tigers in 1974. He was a first-round pick. And while he was moving up through the Tigers farm system in Lakeland, he was converted to a catcher, would eventually replace Milt May as the team's regular catcher in 1979. Now, he was an avid weightlifter, and Sparky Anderson didn't necessarily agree with this. And in fact, Sparky wasn't the only one who thought that weightlifting was odd. There was a rather erroneous assumption prior to the 1980s, I would say, that baseball players who lifted weights, while their muscles would get too big, they would be too tight, they would be too prone to injuries, when actually the exact opposite was the case. Now, of course, we're talking about non-steroid muscles. This is simply through physical activity. And somebody who benefited the most and who actually changed the thinking of weightlifting was Nolan Ryan. Ryan was a very avid weightlifter in the 70s when he was with the Angels, and was most famous for developing his leg muscles, which provided a lot of the longevity in his career, because pitchers are pushing off that mound with that back leg. Well, if you've got pretty steady leg muscles, it's not just your leg, it's your butt, it's your lower back muscles, gives you a little more velocity. And that's why a lot of the prime fastball pitchers of the last, 40 years, guys like Ryan and Roger Clemens in particular, when he wasn't sticking needles in his ass, when they were doing weightlifting, they were able to prolong their careers quite a bit. So Parrish was, much like Ryan, very much at the forefront of the weightlifting ideal in baseball, which really did finally catch on in the mid-80s. And now to think of a Major League Baseball locker room without a weight room, that's such a foreign idea. It's a little bit of a head scratcher. It's not that long ago, the late 70s, early 80s, when people were, looking at baseball players lifting weights as being an odd kind of thing. Well, after 10 years with the Tigers, he signed as a free agent with the Philadelphia Phillies. Phillies built an entire marketing campaign around him, but he really struggled offensively. Much like anybody else who struggles in Philadelphia, was basically run out of town by the Phillies fans. And he would later on have a pretty good stint in California with the Angels, and then bounced around from Seattle to Cleveland to Pittsburgh, wrapped up his major league career officially with the Toronto Blue Jays, even though he did get some minor league offers and tryout opportunities in the mid-90s. Now, after he retired, he became a roving catching instructor for the Royals, later a coach with the Dodgers AA team in San Antonio, joined the broadcast crew in Detroit, but then became part of the coaching crew as well. So, in fact, his coaching career in Detroit bookended his broadcast career. He was part of the crew from 1999 to 2001, became a broadcaster in 2002, and then when Alan Trammell became the manager of the Tigers, he went back on the field and was dismissed with Trammell's crew in 2005. Later became a minor league manager in the Dodgers farm system, and was most recently a manager of the AA Erie Seawolves, part of Detroit's system, and later the single-A Western Michigan Whitecaps manager of the Midwest League, again, part of Detroit's system. Now, he has got two sons who are in professional baseball, and his oldest son, David Parrish, was selected in the 2000 draft by the Yankees and bounced around in the minor leagues up through 2008. And finally, we're looking at the expansion team, the Florida Marlins, here through the eyes of Nigel Wilson. Not exactly, as it would turn out, the best representative for a minor league team, but much like Nigel Wilson was the first pick of the Florida Marlins in the 93 expansion draft, he had just as illustrious of a major league career as David Need, the former first round or first overall pick of the Colorado Rockies in the 93 draft. You know, there's a good joke there about the Atlanta Braves. If the Braves ever cast off a pitcher, you didn't want him, because if he wasn't good enough for the Braves, he certainly wasn't good enough for any other team. And that was certainly the case with Nigel Wilson and the Marlins. Now, Wilson was from Ontario and was drafted, or actually a free agent of the Blue Jays. And if you think about the Blue Jays outfield in 1992, you had Joe Carter, you had Devon White, you had Candy Maldonado, you had, you know, a veteran presence like Pat Tabler. You could put Ed Sprague out in the outfield if you wanted to. Derek Bell was still in the organization. There just wasn't any room for Nigel Wilson, especially since the Jays would eventually go out and get Ricky Henderson the next season. So Nigel Wilson was expendable. He was exposed in the major league draft, or the expansion draft, excuse me, and he was selected first by the Marlins. He was the second overall selection. Now, he only had a very brief career in the major leagues with the Marlins in 1993 and later the Cincinnati Reds in 1995, and he managed to go 0-4 everything with both the Marlins and the Reds. He went 0-23 in his time with those two teams with 15 strikeouts, no walks, was never hit by a pitch. So you can imagine how dreadful his on-base percentage was, nonetheless his batting average. Finally, after an 0-2 start with the Cleveland Indians with one strikeout in 1996, he finally collected his first major league hit with his 26th at-bat. He would only have three major league hits in his major league career, which ended in 1996. His official stat runs .086 batting average. Two of his three hits, however, were home runs, so he did flash some power, and he had five RBI. Now, where Nigel Wilson fell apart in the major leagues, he stood out in Japan. He was a stud player, a massive home run hitter for the Nippon Ham Fighters in the late 1990s. And in fact, he would tie a Japanese league record by hitting four home runs in four consecutive at-bats on June 21st, 1997, just the second player in Japanese history, along with the great Sadaharu Oh, ending that season with 37 home runs that led the league. And he also hit 33 home runs in 1998, 37 home runs in 2000. He didn't play much of the 1999 season due to injury. And he tried a successful major league comeback with the Yankees, however, did not make the major league roster after a minor league invitation. He's remembered as one of the best non-Japanese players to ever play for the Nippon Ham Fighters, and his Japanese career line reads a 265 average, 119 home runs, and 337 RBI. Now, his father was not Mookie Wilson. He was actually a cricket player in Trinidad. So after emigrating to Canada and having Nigel move on up through the ranks in Canada and his brief foray into Major League ball and Japanese ball, he moved back to Ontario, lives in Ajax, Ontario, has owned and operated the Competitive Edge Sports Training Facility in Ajax for the last 11 years. His wife and three children live there, and he has an older daughter, I believe from a separate marriage, Latoya Ali, who is a YouTube personality married to Adam Ali, and they have a couple of children there. So a very interesting story of Nigel Wilson. One of the interesting footnotes, and this kind of goes back to our discussion when we talked about the airbrushing of cards for the 1977 set and the Mariners and the Blue Jays, you know, whatever happened to some of the Florida Marlins players. Well, you know, it's interesting. The, you know, you had players like Jeff Conine, who would have a pretty good career, is still part of the Marlins broadcast team. Yeah, Nigel Wilson, you know, one of the, you know, unfortunate names of that draft there. Brian Harvey. I'm getting my Angels relievers mixed up here. Brian Harvey, who we discussed in the previous podcast, reviving his career for a few years, was an all-star with the Marlins for a couple years, shortly after getting claimed from the Angels off the expansion draft. So you had some players who stood out. One player who did stand out, who was drafted by the Marlins, but of course would become much more famous with the San Diego Padres, Trevor Hoffman, another one of those great what-if situations. Now the Marlins, of course, pretty much bought their World Series in 1997 and developed but refused to maintain a World Series winner in 2003, have been struggling ever since then to really grab a foothold in the bandwagon sports town of Miami. But Nigel Wilson, the epitome of expansion draft players, as somebody who had a lot of potential, but as often is the case with expansion teams, typically doesn't last very long with that team, or in some cases, the major leagues, especially for a young player. So there you go, a look at 93 Stadium Club, the pumpkin spice of premium brands in the mid-90s. And much like pumpkin spice is having a flash or a backlash and is also dealing with a lot of people who are just sick and tired of pumpkin spice everything, by 1993 and certainly in ensuing years, the magic that was Stadium Club, what it created in 1991, had become middle of the road by 1993, and in the following years would just become part of the roadkill as the hobby collapsed upon itself and took several years to rebuild. But again, the Stadium Club brand is alive and well if you collect cards, the current sets these days. And if you want to collect the top Stadium Club 1993 set, like I said, I bought this at a card show for, I think, $10 for the box, something like that. And I did look online. You can get Series 1, 2, or 3 boxes for pretty cheap, you know, including shipping. You can get them for around $15 to $18. And as always, when it comes to junk wax, anytime you're able to offer removing junk wax from the hands of a local card shop or at a card show, you will be greeted with hugs, kisses, bonus cards, and that is after you pick up the card seller off the floor because somebody actually wants junk wax purchased. So you can probably get this for much less if you look around for it a little bit. And in fact, you could probably get a box of each Series 1, 2, and 3 for probably a grand total of $20 or $25. And as I mentioned, with very little duplication in the packs, you'll be able to assemble most, if not all, of the set. And you're probably just going to be missing, if you do all three cards or all three series, you're probably just going to be missing maybe 30, 40 cards off the bat. And those will be pretty easy to attain. So yeah, you could have a top Stadium Club set from 1993 altogether, $30, maybe $35, something like that. So this is another bargain bin beauty, one of the beauties of the junk wax era. You can get a decent looking set. It has some star power, not any glamorous rookie cards, but you can get them for a pretty affordable price nowadays. So if you have any thoughts about Topps Stadium Club, about any of the players we talked about, or any of the junk wax cards, the pumpkin spice of the world, yeah, we'll open it up to that. Talk about it on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. Certainly looking forward to your comments. Again, if you would like to make a cash donation to the program to keep the program going strong, to buy some better cards than 93 Topps Stadium Club, or to just keep our main program and archive running along on Audio Boom and all the various RSS feeds, you can do so via PayPal at paypal.me/Wax Ecstatic. And again, I thank everybody who has donated and those who are going to donate in the future. Thank you for keeping this program alive and well. We'll be back 2 weeks from today, Friday, September 27th, and we'll be talking about some more classic, or in some cases, not so classic cardboard on Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.